HPPodCraft.com.
The steely light of daybreak, increasing in volume and intensity as the east grew larger with the day, showed clearly at length that the prodigious yet elegant Arabian bed was empty. What might tenderly have cradled the slumbers of some exquisite fair of romance now contained no human occupant at all. The whole immense room, its air dry and thin as if burnt, was quiet as a sepulchre. To the right of the bed towered a vast and heavily carved wardrobe. To the left, a lofty fireplace of stone, flanked by its grinning, frigid dogs. A few cumbrous and obscure oil paintings hung on the walls, and, like the draperies of a proscenium, the fringed and valanced damask curtains on either side the two high windows poured down their motionless cataract of crimson. They had been left undrawn overnight, and yet gave the scene a slight theatricality, a theatricality which the painted nymphs disporting themselves on the ceiling scarcely helped to dispel.
Dispel the nymphs? What for? Those guys know how to party. Woo! For it is November, the month of Walter Delamere, and that lovely reading that you heard was from Walt's story Out of the Deep, a story that we're going to be covering here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are here at HPPodCraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
It is indeed November. We did a survey on Twitter asking listeners what is better, the easy to say and fun name, Merevember, or November, which sounds like a line from the Jodie Foster movie Nell. They went for the latter with 242 votes. It was 44% Merevember. Ah, oh, so close. 56% November. So wow. November is the winner. Chris, you did it. Congratulations.
Well, it's a better title, man.
I was going to give you a call to concede. There's this time difference, so I didn't want to wake you up. I was a little disappointed by the results, but then I remembered, hey, you know, if everybody liked cool things, it wouldn't be cool. So the 44% of us who like Merevember, we'll always have it. We'll start our own little club. But I was heartened by some of the suggestions we got in response to this poll.
Yeah, sure.
Aiden Severs suggested Merevember. It's a pretty good compromise.
Yeah, I like that, actually.
Calico Dad went another way with No De La Bear. That was pretty good. But Astrofina got the gold, in my opinion, with Oops, Walter De La Mare. Because it is kind of Oops, Walter De La Mare month. Because so far, I felt like you are feeling maybe this was a bit of a mistake.
I am feeling like this was a mistake. I keep holding on to the love, the deep love I had for Seton's aunt, and then these stories are not enjoyable.
I liked this one. I've actually liked them both pretty good, but I know where you're coming from as well. We'll get into all that. In the meantime, who was that reader we heard at the top?
Like, you gotta ask. It's an old favorite. You know him. You love him. You want to be loved by him. That's right. It's Greg Johnson. Greg will be returning to BBC Two in January for Series 2 of the MASH Report.
I did think it was great to get Greg for this show in particular. Mm-hmm. I thought it was relevant because I know that he did have a nymph painting business. So this material probably really connects with him. You remember that? It was like a subscription thing. You'd pay like $1 a month and Greg would break into your house and paint a nymph on the ceiling. I think it was called It's Hard Out Here for a Nymph. And actually, it was hard because nobody really wanted the service. You know, he was arrested several times. So it's good to hear that he's doing so well now. Cheers, mate. I've been saying that lately. It sounds really creepy when an American says mate.
Cheers, mate.
Doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't.
Not at all.
It sounds like two creatures copulating.
Yeah, it just sounds kind of vaguely threatening.
Cheers, mate.
Why am I your mate? I don't want to mate with you. Speaking of creepy, let's get into this story, Out of the Deep.
So the story starts off with this fancy bedroom, and this guy, Jimmy, is staying there. It's not his room, or at least it's his room now, but it used to belong to his uncle.
It's a really nice, expensive room. Those aforementioned nymphs are painted on the ceiling. The room itself, it's treated like a character. The setting is very much treated like a character in the story, and it's indifferent to whether Jimmy is there or not. In this section, we get a slight description of Jimmy. It seems like he's an older guy, keeps to himself, not particularly social.
Find out that Jimmy is here alone, except for the housekeeper, Mrs. Thripps. Jimmy has inherited the house from his uncle, Timothy, and Aunt Charlotte.
And he lived in this house for a while when he was very young. Nothing is described clearly in terms of what that experience was like or why it happened or anything.
Yeah.
But you get the sense that this boyhood life, it wasn't a good one.
No.
When he lived there, he was actually living in the attic. And I don't think it was a cool Greg Brady attic room either. Here's a description of him seeing the attic room again. Just one single glance in from the high, narrow doorway upstairs had convinced him that the attic in which he was wont to sleep as a small boy was simply out of the question. A black, heavy flood of rage swept over him at sight of it. He had never before positively realized the abominations of that early past.
Oof.
So something is bad about him having lived here as a child.
It's probably that he now has the perspective as an adult. He grew up there and he didn't think anything of it because you're just a kid and that's your life.
Yeah.
But when he's an adult, comes back and looks at it, he's like, oh my God, they made me live in there? That is terrible.
Got me on his side.
So Jimmy wasn't so keen on moving in. It took him almost 3 years before he did. Now that he has the house, he's been selling little bits off here and there to make some money. Gold candle holders and, you know, things like that.
But even though the house was left to him, he's not entirely sure he's got a legal right to sell off all of these contents. These lawyers are active. Mm. They've got Mrs. Thripps in there maintaining the property.
Yeah.
So what he's doing is he's kind of sneakily selling things off.
Yeah.
Bit by bit to fund his life. And there's enough collectibles in this house that he can do that. His uncle apparently was a collector of some kind.
So a few days ago, he gave a bell rope a little tug. Now, in that room, there was, I don't think there was a description of it at the top, but in that fancy room, there's a bell rope. You know, one of those things that you pull, rings a bell, and the servants know that you want something, they come and check it out.
There are bell ropes in many rooms in this house, actually. There's one up in the attic, there's one in the room that he's living in now, all linking to a series of bells.
Before we get to when he pulls the rope, we go to the day before his first tug, where Jimmy is taking a bunch of stuff on Tippy Pond, and the guy offers him some money. But then he says, no, give me half of what you offered.
I think it's clear his uncle valued all of these things in the house much higher than he did his relationship with his boy.
Yes.
Jimmy is selling them off in an almost vindictive way. You know, he's taking far less than they're actually worth.
And so
the dealer is obviously happy to do it. But I think that what he's doing here is he's giving him, and the dealer quotes him, a price that's already too low for what these things are worth. And he says, give me half of that. Because he's just, you know, hates these people. Wants to get rid of his junk at a poor price. That's what I took out of it. He calls this the hated house, so it was clearly not a good experience for him. When he describes the house, he says, that high cupboard in the corner from which certain bodiless shapes had been wont to issue and stoop at him cowering out of his dreams. The crab-patterned paper that came alive as you stared. The mouse holes, the rusty grate, trumpet of every wind that blows. These objects at once lustily shouted at him in their own original tongues. Not only was it an uncomfortable experience for him, but it seems like he was scared of this place, too, as a young kid. There was some kind of trauma here, whether it was real or imagined. Quite apart from themselves, they reminded him of incidents and experiences, which at the time could scarcely have been so nauseous as they now seemed in retrospect. He found himself suffocatingly resentful, even of what must have been kindly intentions. To your point, he's looking at some conditions and saying, wow, this was worse than I thought. But also, his hatred towards the whole household is extended to even what might have been nice things that they did for him. Is distasteful to him. And that speaks a lot to this whole story. It's very subjective. This whole thing's happening in his head. Which is why a lot of it's confusing and we're not sure what's real and what's not, even when it comes down to other characters in the story.
I found it very difficult to try and summarize what happens because I don't really know what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, even when he's describing scenes where there's somebody standing there, but then they're not there, and then something's broken, somebody's holding it. I don't really understand.
I mean, this is an impressionistic story. I think it's a subjective haunted house story, meaning that you don't know whether the ghosts are real or not.
Mm-hmm.
They're in his mind or not. And I knew we were going to have a hard time getting through the synopsis of it because it's just not a plot-driven story. It jumps all over the place in time, and it's got the feel of somebody on their deathbed thinking through their life and maybe being a little crazy, which is, I think, the point.
So Uncle Timothy was very strict with Jimmy, or maybe he just didn't like Jimmy very much. It's hard to tell.
Well, he tells this little story about how his uncle would make him look at his microscope. His uncle would take it out of the box. He'd put up the microscope, put the slides in there. It says he'd make him examine the little darting horrors of magnified life. But he would not let the boy operate it. Don't touch it. It was that kind of relationship. And I was kind of connecting with this part of the story. I had a babysitter that was like this for a short amount of time. He had model trains in the basement, which are the coolest. I mean, like the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
Little village, town, miniatures. He would say, all right, come down and look at this. But I couldn't touch any of it. I had to like stand against the wall.
What?
Yeah. And he would turn it on and it would go around. And if I got close to it, he would yell at me.
Oh my God.
Which is like, how can you put toys in front of a child and not let them touch?
Oh my God.
You know, or let them be inquisitive about them.
That is terrible.
Oh, he was horrible. In fact, I actually stopped going to the babysitter because he hit me.
Because I
spilled some stuff on the carpet and he flew into a rage. Yeah, that guy ended up going to jail for beating on his wife. That's a whole other story, but it was a kind of an experience like that where it was he had all of these cool things, but you just couldn't look at them or touch them. So cruel. And it seems like in a lot of ways, this wasn't a good environment for a child in the story here because he remembers sitting in the attic and staring at the rain out the window. They just wouldn't give him anything to do.
I'm still thinking about that guy.
I don't. That's a whole rabbit hole we can go down.
Well, occasionally, sometimes you drop bombs on the show. And you just kind of keep going. And I'm like, what?
We have weird fiction to cover.
I'm sorry to hear. I've never heard that story before.
Yeah, it was kind of traumatic.
Of course it was. Jeez.
It was a little bit like a Porth Farm situation, too. They were like religious fundamentalists.
Oh,
she wasn't allowed to cut her hair, you know? So it was always up in this bun. And I remember she took it out and it was like, I've never seen that much hair. She looked like Cousin It. Isn't that the Harry?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, man, it blew my little young mind. I'd never seen somebody with that much hair in my life.
Feeling so bad for young Chad Pfeiffer. That's terrible, dude.
I'll drop some more bombs in this episode. Just you wait.
Back to the story. Looking around the house, Jimmy notices multiple bell ropes. Now, he remembers the old servant of the house, Soames. Soames also seemed to treat Jimmy very poorly, but not overtly. Just he wasn't very nice to him.
And there's some question about who Soames was. It might have been his Uncle Timothy's impoverished first cousin or illegitimate stepbrother.
Mm.
Soames was mean to him as well. He used to wring his ears, and if there was crappy food to be had, that's what he would get, right? Mm-hmm. So if there was nice food downstairs, he'd bring him up to the attic, whatever was the worst of that. And he was frightened of the dark. Now, here's the thing. Up in that attic, they wouldn't let him have candles or light or anything up there. It says, you know very well your dear uncle will not permit gas in the attic, so he couldn't bring a lantern up there. And they say, why are you such a cowardly boy and so wickedly frightened of the dark? Now, Jimmy, now that he's moved back into this house, however,
yeah,
he's got candles everywhere. The place is lit like a Prince video. He's getting their best wax candles and putting them up everywhere.
Yeah.
The place is always lit up now.
When he first got the house, he did a thorough search of the place, taking stock of what was there.
It becomes like a routine for him, oddly. He roams around the house, takes stock of everything. He's making lists. I didn't understand what his deal was, even up until this point. But there was finally a hint that, oh, he's dying. Because it says he was not waiting for anything, except for the hour, maybe, when he would have to wait no more.
Yeah.
I wasn't even necessarily aware that he was an older guy.
No.
What was going on with him?
No.
You kind of over time puzzle together. I think he's got TB.
Yeah. That's my guess too. But first reading, I just had no idea what the hell was going on. The second reading through, I was able to piece bits here and there, but still, I'd say a quarter of it is a complete mystery to me. So
it continues to be a mystery.
Hopefully you understand it a little bit more than I do.
I doubt it.
He wonders why Mrs. Thripps, the housekeeper, never took anything. She's well paid, of course, but still, nobody would know.
Yeah.
Because they're dead. So why not, you know, take something, make a little extra cash? But she was just kind of a quiet person, follow the rules.
Yeah, it seems like she is very firmly rooted in the real world. She's an outsider from what his experience is. She's a hired hand. She's not really connected to the history of this place.
Yeah.
Also, in his conversations with her, we get closer to maybe what his condition is because he says, perhaps if he could have persuaded himself to talk sensibly and not to gesticulate, not to laugh himself so easily into a fit of coughing.
Yeah.
She would have proved better company. So little suggestions like that eventually make it clear. He's got TB consumption. He's on the way out. And that this is a kind of an end of life story.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to know if the ghosts we're about to confront are real ghosts, memories, regrets.
Mm-hmm.
But he's seen something. He says it was indeed her alarm when he asked her if she had happened to notice any young man about the house that had irritated him. Though, of course, it was hardly fair not to explain what had given rise to the question. That was perfectly simple. It was like this. So he sets up that he's seen some young man in the house.
Yeah.
This servant hasn't.
No.
And it possibly ghostly. So that now we're going to get whatever this ghost story is.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy also is the kind of guy who never really could sleep. He would never sleep the whole night through.
It says his was a wretchedly active mind. Great, great description of an insomniac.
He was a good boy when young, but mostly out of fear and not love. Now, the night after he sold off his stuff, he was in the house alone. And because of that, he felt lonely. He didn't want to be there by himself. And then he looked up at that bell cord and he thought about Soames, how he kind of wanted some company. And he thought, you know, I kind of want to pull it because Soames would come in and ask me what I needed or whatever. And he's sort of nostalgia, but he doesn't pull it because he's a little creeped out by it. He doesn't understand why he won't pull it. But then he does pull it. And as he's lying there and he opens his eyes and he sees a young servant man standing there. He doesn't say anything, but he just seems to be waiting for instructions. And Jimmy wasn't sure whether he was dreaming or not.
The whole setup's pretty cool. It's doing something to prove that you're not scared of it. That's the way he sets it up.
Yeah.
It says he would, in fact, rather remain alone than chance summoning, well, any once animate relic of the distant past. So he's already afraid that if he pulls that bell, something from his past is going to show up.
Mm-hmm.
He says, but obviously the most practical way of proving, if only to yourself, that you can be content with your own reconnaissances in the very dead of night was to demonstrate to that self that, even if you should ask for it, assistance would not be forthcoming.
Mm.
We've talked about that before. You know you're going to walk by that mirror in the hallway, you know, in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
You make a scary face into it just to prove to yourself you're not afraid, you know.
Or
you know how you do something to prove to yourself that it's not scary. That's why he pulls that bell cord.
So over the next few days, Jimmy would think about the servant and about how he was young, and he looked a little like himself. He looked like Jimmy. But for now, he was just uncomfortable there in the silence as the servant is waiting for him. It cuts to the future, and then it goes back to the past. Within the same paragraph. So again, that's one of the many confusing elements of this.
It's probably confusing listening to this show because we're jumping all over the place. But essentially what happened is he pulled that bell cord and this young guy showed up.
Yeah, and they just stare at each other.
Yeah.
He turns away and he says, "It is only to tell you that I shall need nothing more tonight." That was it. That's what he says to the ghost or the ghost butler boy, whatever he is.
Ghost butler boy. The alternative title of this story. I thought it was either a ghost or possibly a memory of himself. Was it himself?
Yeah, but he would never serve. He would never answer the bell.
True. I know. I don't know.
The servant bows slightly after he says this and then just leaves. Mm-hmm. That night, Jimmy slept like an infant, which again is a phrase I hate because obviously these people never had children because freaking infants don't sleep.
They've just seen photos of babies sleeping.
When they do sleep, they are freaking precious and quiet and they have that little soft little breath, but man, they don't do it for long. Well, now they do. My kids, 6 and 3, they're really good at staying asleep at night. It's pretty awesome, but it took a lot of hard work to get there.
Sure. I've slept like an infant around you where I like peed my pants and then woke you up in the middle of the night crying.
So in the morning, Jimmy wakes up. He feels great. And he thinks it was all just a dream.
And when he's doing his rounds, well, he thinks it was all a dream, but he still searches around for some kind of secret room, thinking maybe there is a young man that's staying here in a room I don't know about. Makes no sense.
So he's checking out the bells when Mrs. Thripps comes in and he says to her that he thinks that they should, you know, be different notes, like on a scale, these bells. And then he just sort of babbles about his idea of using different notes for different needs. And then she just kind of says, okay.
Because there's like a series of bells, right? So the servants know which room is being rung.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you should tune them up so you can kind of play a little music. It's really stupid. But there is a strange Lovecraftian thing he says. Mm-hmm. He says, has it ever occurred to you that the first campanologist's real intention was not so much to call the congregation as to summon, well, what the congregation's after? A campanologist being, I think, somebody who's a specialist in bells. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was interesting. So we think of the church bells as summoning us to go to church. But maybe the first one was, you know, rigged those up because they're trying to summon something from outside of this world, you know, something that these people were worshiping. That's really what the bells are there for.
Right.
And I thought that was kind of a cool,
I see that. So that night he lays in bed, not sleeping, thinking about the past, and he wants to pull that bell rope again, but he doesn't, and he falls asleep.
He seems to be under a spell of this thing, though, because it says the next day a horrible lassitude descended upon him. For the better part of an hour, he had stood staring out of the drawing room window into the London street. So, I don't know, some kind of change or...
Yes.
Once he's pulled this thing, he's in some kind of haunting spell, I think.
A few nights later, he's in bed again. Jimmy wakes up abruptly, covered in sweat, and his hands on the bell rope.
That's what I'm talking... Yeah, so like he's doing it against his will, even.
The room is lit, so he's fine, and he lays down, but he knows someone just came in the room, but he doesn't look, and he just starts talking. They're dreadfully out of season, you know. Dreadfully. But what I'm really pining for is a bunch of primroses. A primrose by the river's brim. Must be a little conservative. He doesn't know who he's talking to, but finally he turns and looks, and there's nobody there. And then he feels himself drifting back to sleep, but then he opens his eyes and he sees this weird little girl standing in the doorway.
Stuff was kind of creepy because I was expecting the young guy again. This wholly new character shows up.
Yeah, yeah. And she's carrying some sort of kitchen bowl full of water.
He found himself then watching this new visitor without the least trace of astonishment or even of surprise. And as his dark eyes coursed over the child, he simply couldn't decide whether she most closely took after Soames Jr. or Mrs. Thripps. All he could positively assure himself of was just the look, the family likeness. And that in itself was a queerish coincidence, since whatever your views might be regarding Soames Jr., Mrs. Thripps was real enough. As real, at any rate, as her scrubbing brush and her wholesome, evil-smelling soap. As a matter of fact, Jimmy was taking a very tight hold of himself. His mind might fancifully be compared to a quiet, green, swarming valley between steep, rock-bound hills in which a violent battle was proceeding. Standards and horsemen and smoke and terror and violence, but no sound.
I really couldn't figure out who this girl is or why in the world she would resemble Mrs. Thripps. I mean, I described Mrs. Thripps as an outsider. I thought she had nothing to do with
yeah.
this.
Yeah, yeah.
When he references Soames Jr., that's what he's been calling the young man, because that young man looks a little like Soames.
Right.
As well as him. I feel like this is some near-death memory, like he's waiting to die alone. Maybe memories are intruding, and they don't necessarily make a lot of sense. And I don't think his rambling necessarily makes a lot of sense.
Okay, good. As long as it's not me, I'm feeling like an idiot when I'm reading this thing going, I spent so much time going over this, trying to decipher it. It was like the Dead Sea Scrolls or something. And it's just, I don't think there's anything to decipher. I think I've looked at it the wrong way.
No, it's just all hints and suggestions. Here, I mean, there's a suggestion that maybe he did have a relationship at one time with this girl. It says, she meant no ill. She was demure, faraway, harmless-looking creature, ages ago. On the other hand, he wished to heaven they would leave him alone. They were pestering him. He knew perfectly well how far he was gone and bitterly resented this renewed interference. And if there was one thing he detested, it was being made to look silly. I hope you're trying to be a good little boy. You haven't been talking to the servants. So he's having some memory that maybe he got in trouble for talking to the servants. And I thought, oh, so maybe this was a servant girl from back then.
He doesn't remember her. She's new to him.
Yeah, no, I know.
So it's all, man. Anyway.
It's all jumbled up, isn't it?
The kid says nothing, just brings a bowl of water with a primrose and sets it down on the table. After she puts it down, she just looks at him, like almost through him. He thinks, is she waiting for a tip? He says, look here, it's all very well. You've managed things quite admirably, considering your age and the season and so on. But I didn't ask for primroses. I asked for violets. That very old trick, very old trick. Now, he did ask for primroses.
Yes.
She then looks like she's thinking about something, about what he said. But then she's gone, and he says, and this is kind of a cool, like, he doesn't remember seeing the back of her head. So she, like, somehow backed out of the room or was just, it's very dreamlike.
It is. I definitely didn't understand what the primrose violet trick was.
Jimmy is super angry, flies out of bed with a bowl, and he goes out into the hall calling out, look here, you can cheat and you can cheat, but to half strangle a fellow in his sleep and send him up the snuffling caretaker's daughter? What's happening?
I think he was choking already, and that's why he pulled on the bell rope, but then the girl came up and he's mad that it's the girl, and now he doesn't want the flower.
Yes.
Who knows, but there's an effect here, right? Because he...
So Jimmy puts the bowl down on the floor, and then he hears the sound like an animal crawling under the staircase.
It says, it was going to be tit for tat then. The miserable menage had let loose its menagerie. That. They were going to experiment with the mouse cupboard and keyhole trickery of his childhood. Again, I think that he's saying, uh-oh, I've made these ghosts mad, so now they're going to unleash all the monsters.
And then something does come up the stairs, and he freezes. It says... What was peering steadily in upon him out of the obscurity beyond the door was merely a blurred, whitish, beast-like shape with still, passive, almost stagnant eyes and its immense, fixed face.
A perfectly ludicrous object on paper, yet a creature so nauseous to soul and body and with so obscene a greed in its motionless, pig-like grin that with one vertiginous swirl, Jimmy's candles had swept up in his hand like a lateral race of streaming planets into outer darkness.
So it's... slams all of his candles and knocks him out.
He basically lets the light out. But as far as he knows, he's still standing in the dark with this thing there.
Right.
Yeah. It was a pretty scary scene.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what it is.
So he staggers to bed, but he doesn't pull the rope. So he wakes up, gingerly confronts Mrs. Thripps. It's good, you know, if you come in and you're doing some cleaning at night, that you don't really need to do that. You know, there's a bit of an accident with all the primrose. So, you know, so he's just kind of babbling again. And she just doesn't understand what the heck he's talking about.
He's also saying, hey, there should have been water on the floor, some shards of glass or something, right? There's nothing.
There's nothing there, yeah.
That's why he's mad, because you cleaned up, clearly.
Right. Mrs. Thripps has no idea what he's talking about. No broken bowls or anything were found. He's talking crazy. She implores Jimmy to let her call the doctor, and she's worried about him.
So she's aware that there's some haunting happening in the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, it says, my heart's in my mouth for fear there won't be anything in the house but what can't answer back. I mean,
she's
aware there's something going on there.
Well, there's ghosts, but like ghosts of memories. And I think what she's referring to is him dying, and she doesn't want him to die. And it's the fear of him dying, not the fear of the ghost.
But there was something Mrs. Thripps said here that made me think she knows it's haunted. It says, when that door there closes after me, and every day drawing out steady as you can see without so much as glancing at the clock, I say to myself, well... better that poor young gentleman alone up there at night, cough and all, than me. I wouldn't sleep in the house, sir. Not if he was to offer me a plate full of sovereigns.
Okay.
And he says, on my oath, I assure you, there's absolutely nothing or nobody in this old barn of a museum except you and me. Nobody unless, of course, you will understand one happens to pull the bell. And that we're not likely to do in broad daylight, are we, Mrs. Thripps? So he might just be nuts, but apparently the only way you can summon these ghosts is to pull that bell. The story descends into a lot of introspection on the part of Jimmy, which is really hard to summarize. Mm-hmm. He's talking about keeping himself busy, and he concludes with, "Unless you were preternaturally busy and preoccupied, you simply couldn't live on in a haunted house without occasionally being reminded of its ghosts." And I felt like that was the heart and theme of the story here.
Mm-hmm.
The past creeps up on you. It haunts us all.
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's what this is. It's just an illustration of a man on his deathbed being revisited by the ghosts of his past, I think, maybe. Who knows?
Yeah.
Upstairs, he's really sick, contemplating cutting the bell. But then he turns and he sees the girl there. And he didn't pull the cord. He didn't summon her.
No.
She was smiling as if in hope. She was waiting to be told to go. And it seemed to Jimmy that in its patient face hung veil upon veil of uncountable faces of the past, in paint, stone, actuality, dream, that he had glanced at or brooded on in the enormous history of his life. "I understand, my dear," he said, "and it was courtesy itself of you to look in when I didn't ring." Now, he tells the girl to get lost, reminds her, "Hey, I've got Mrs. Thripps. I may be dying, but I still have somebody who's here in the material world that I'm friends with.
Right.
I'm going to decide when I die, and I'm going to be the one that pulls the bell." So I think maybe this is him reckoning with the meaning of life or something.
Hmm.
When he's going, "I've got to decide what I want when I pull the bell." I think that's his last kind of thing he's trying to decide.
Right.
Because before he told him, "Just go away. I don't know what I just want to let you know you were done for the night."
Hmm.
And then there was a whole thing with the primroses. He just came up with that on the spot. So it's like he's trying to figure out, when I finally pull that bell for the last time, what is it going to be all worth? What do I want? I think.
Yeah, that sounds right to me.
He sleeps for a while after the girl goes, and then he wakes and he tries to rise. He's very frail. It says he gathered up the tartan traveling shawl that had tented in his scarecrow knees and lit the only candle in his crystal stick. So he's leaving this room, and he's headed somewhere.
That is why when, next morning, out of a sounding, slanting shower of rain, Mrs. Thripps admitted herself into the house at the area door, she found the young man, still in his clothes, lying very fast asleep indeed on the truckle bed in the attic. His hands were not only crossed, but convulsively clenched in that position on his breast. And it appeared from certain distressing indications that he must have experienced a severe struggle to refrain from a wild blind tug at the looped-up length of knotted whipcord over his head. As a matter of fact, it did not occur to the littered old charwoman's mind to speculate whether or not Jimmy had actually made such a last attempt, or whether he had been content merely to wait on a Soames who might perhaps, like all good servants, come when he was wanted rather than when he was called. All her own small knowledge of Soameses, though not without comfort, had been acquired at second hand. Nor did Mrs. Thripps waste time in surmising how Jimmy could ever have persuaded himself to loop up the cord like that out of his reach, unless he had first become abysmally ill-content with his small, primitive, and belated knowledge of campanology. She merely looked at what was left of him, her old face almost comically transfixed in its appearance of pity, horror, astonishment, and curiosity.
And that is the end.
Yeah, it is.
To a very confusing story. If you are the type of person who likes to read things that are entirely subjective, then you will like this.
Yeah.
If you need a little bit of plot, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Man, if you know what you're getting into, you can enjoy something a lot more. Or if your expectations... I guess I'm just still holding out for a Seton's aunt. You know, like,
right.
I love that story so much. It had such great characters, such great atmosphere. It was subtle.
And it had all these weird elements.
It was totally weird. It was, nothing really even happens in that story as well, but it hits. It hits that perfect balance for me. Of course, this is all subjective when we're doing these things. I'm just a guy.
Yeah.
I just read a bunch of stories and this is how I feel about them. You know, I'm not a scholar. I'm not an expert. And frankly, there's a lot of scholars and experts that have opinions on stories that I think are totally wackadoodle.
Right. You know, we try to champion weird fiction here. I think some people get mad when we don't champion all weird fiction, specifically when we're talking about M.R. James or some of these kinds of things where maybe we don't connect with the material. I resent it when somebody infers that it's because I'm stupid. You know, I do. It actually kind of makes me mad.
Sure.
I'm not an idiot. I just had, these are my tastes.
You know,
we're doing our best here. Well, here in the introduction to this book I have, it says, "What qualities contribute to the making of a really good ghost story? A deftly crafted air of unease and suspense is essential. A well-defined sense of place is also an advantage." And then it compares this his work to Henry James' The Turn of the Screw.
Mm-hmm.
It says, "James' tale certainly has the atmosphere, the location, and the troubled protagonist, but it also raises numerous tantalizing questions. Are the ghosts in the story real, or do they exist within the mind of the governess? Do the children within her care see the ghost but refuse to admit it, or are they totally innocent and merely bewildered by events? Is the governess malevolent or mad, or is she rather the only hope of salvation? James' ability to weave ambiguity into the fabric of the tale makes it a sublime ghost story. As the stories in this collection reveal, Walter Delamere possessed a very similar ability to create narratives, in which many interpretations are possible, something which, taken together with his perfectly pitched sense of place and his elegant prose, made him one of the finest writers of supernatural tales in the language. It's all about creating possibilities and then never answering any of the questions. So if you know that going in, you might really enjoy this. The writing is really cool.
Yeah.
And evocative.
I guess for me to like a story, and this is just me, I have to be able to connect with it somehow.
Right.
And I have to have some anchor in reality. Once I'm connected, then you can go crazy. You can go anywhere, off the road, places. I don't care. I love it even. But if it doesn't get me initially, I don't enjoy it.
Well, Walter Delamere is actually more famous as a poet than he is as a weird fiction author.
Yeah.
And I think that this more approaches poetry in that it's using words to create interpretive images
right.
in the reader's mind and not necessarily to, go from A to Z.
Right. Yeah.
In terms of a story arc.
There's actually audio recordings that you can find on YouTube of him reading his poetry.
Which is nice. Well, next week we're going to tackle another one. It's called A Recluse. I have no idea if it's going to be like more of this or maybe there'll be ninjas in it. It's one or the other. I know that. Hey, also, I want to once again thank, I didn't say it at the top, but we're using music for this episode, once again, by Wesley Slover from his album Impressions of the Miskatonic.
Yes.
So all the music you've been hearing is from that record. Wesley's the owner and founder of Sonos Sanctus. If you need some music for your podcast film, Midnight Werewolf Beach Bash. I don't know why I keep saying that. I don't know if he has anything that could help that. But if that's what you need, go to wesleyslover.bandcamp.com. I'll put it in the show notes. Thanks again, Wesley, for donating that music to us. And of course, we want to thank that reader.
Oh my God, Greg Johnson, he is extraordinary. Check him out at Eclectic Schlock on Twitter, Greg Johnson Comedy on Facebook, and of course, just Greg Johnson on YouTube. You'll find him quite easily.
You will find him and he will find you.
And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.